All right, let's get it on, and welcome to a special hour of the Mike Boyle Restaurant Show. Yes, indeedy. I recently talked with my next guest. His name is Bob Drury. Bob Drury and Tom Clavin wrote a book called Throne of Grace, A Mountain Man, An Epic Adventure, and The Bloody Conquest of the American West. And I read it, I enjoyed it, I learned a lot, and I thought, you know what? If we're not going to teach history in the public schools, we're going to give you a little bit of history here on the Mike Boyle Restaurant Show, where we talk about restaurants, travel, movies, books, sports, or whatever we feel like talking about. Well, this involves a book, Throne of Grace, but it also involves travel. No, not the Chevy Chase vacation, load everybody in the station wagon and go to Wally World. No, not where we take a little trip down to San Antonio and go on the Riverwalk, not where we drive up to Mount Rushmore. This is exploring the American West on horseback and providing for ourselves while we do it. Gone sometimes for a month, 6 months, a year, even longer. All right, so it's 1803, and Thomas Jefferson, president at the time, has just completed the Louisiana Purchase. He has doubled the size of the United States. At that point, the United States went as far west as the Mississippi River. And a big chunk of land was owned by the French. And it would later, the Louisiana Purchase, encompass parts of 13 states. So you can see how it doubled the size of the United States. And if you get over to the Rockies, and if you go even farther west, it's a little questionable about who actually owns that property. And what place did the Indians play in it? So he sent Lewis and Clark to make a journey to the Pacific Ocean. Well, they went the northern route. But President Jefferson, he said, you know what? We need some people to go the southern route. We need some people to go west on the Oregon Trail. We need some people to go west on the Santa Fe Trail. We need some people to find out what's out there. We just bought something. There's no cell phones. There's no internet. It's 1803, 1804, 1805. So he finds a guy named Jedediah Smith. And Jedediah Smith, maybe not quite as well known as Lewis and Clark, Daniel Boone, Kit Carson, but he's a trapper. He's a hunter whose explorations into forested frontiers on both sides of the Rocky Mountains were the stuff of legends. So I thought what we would do in this segment, in this hour, is we would share with you, the listeners, a little bit of the wanderings of Jedediah Smith. Maybe one of the reasons you haven't heard about him is he died young. He died at 31, but I will assure you of this. He has crammed a whole lot of life into those 31 years. So, Bob Drury, author of Throne of Grace, along with your partner, Tom Clavin, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you, Mike. What a wonderful intro that was.
Well,
you left out one thing that really is important.
Well, why don't you hold on to that, because we've got
an assiduous journal keeper. And if it wasn't for his journals and his long, long, thousand-word letters back east to both politicians and to his family, we probably know even less about the guy than we know right now.
We're talking about the book Throne of Grace, A Mountain Man, An Epic Adventure, and The Bloody Conquest of the American West. I've got the author, Bob Drury, with me. Bob, before we took that brief break, you said Jedediah Smith just kept copious notes on where he went and his travels, and so consequently we benefited by that. We now know a little bit about what was transpiring in that new Louisiana Purchase, and as people, more independent people at that time, began to migrate west. So talk a little bit about his journal and how he kept that going.
Well, when you think of a mountain man, Mike, I mean, I think what comes to mind, and
you almost think illiterate.
Yeah, whiskey swilling,
yeah.
Cigar smoking.
Buffalo shooting, yeah.
womaning up, well, you know, a wife, a quote-unquote wife in every tribe.
Uh-huh.
And Smith was just a different kind of cat. He hated the smell of tobacco smoke. He would politely sip a glass of wine if the occasion called for it, but he wasn't a drinker. He was a very religious man. And while there was we talk about contemporaneous writers, because that's our meat and potatoes. Tom Clavin and I, my co-author, we find that contemporaneous writing is the best way to get into a narrative. And one newspaper man once wrote about Jed Smith that I'm going to make sure I get this right, the mountaintop was his altar and the forest glade his confessional. And so while all his compatriots, and he was a natural leader, and people just gravitated towards him, but while all his compatriots were swilling their whiskey, were smoking their cigars, he was writing down everything he saw. He would take new plant cuttings, plants he had never seen before, and he would send them to botanists back east.
Mm-hmm.
When he traveled, I'm getting a little ahead of myself, but I'll just, when he traveled through what was then Mexican territory, the Mexicans had just thrown off the Spanish colonizers, or through the unclaimed territory of what was called the Oregon Country. Not the Oregon Territory. The Oregon Territory became the state of Oregon. But the Oregon Country at the time encompassed Washington, the states today, Washington, Oregon, Idaho, western sliver of Montana, the tops of Utah and Nevada. And he would just take copious notes, and he would send letters back to the politicians in Washington. I mean, down to counting the amount of cannon in each Mexican presidio, mm-hmm. down to counting the amount of tons of farm implements that the British, through their proxy, the Hudson Bay Company, was shipping down from Canada to open forts and stockades. And Mike, here's the killer. This is what got everybody from presidents to business magnates to railroad men back east upset, is because the British were settling the very trail that you mentioned, the Lewis and Clark trace that you mentioned in your opening.
Mm-hmm.
We thought this was going to be our pathway to a coast-to-coast nation. And here comes the British, right? Then that Oregon Country, it was still unsettled. But I don't mean by people. There were certainly many Indian tribes. But there were ongoing negotiations in London about where the border was going to be between Canada and the United States. At the time, the border only reached as far as the Rocky Mountains at the 49th parallel.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, it was a Scotsman who invented the phrase, or who coined the phrase, possession is 9/10 of the law. And the Britishers knew, if we can get people in there under the guise of beaver trapping, beaver, of course, at the time was the most expensive fur in the world, more than mink, more than any, because I don't want to get into the too deep into the rabbit hole of beaver fur, but let's just say it was waterproof.
Mm-hmm.
And here's a statistic that just blew my mind. In the first half of the 19th century, from 1800 to 1850, British milliners, hat makers, shipped 20 million pieces of beaver headgear to the continent. It was haute couture in Paris, it was Spain, Germany, even to the West Coast, the Chinese would make shawls and full-length beaver coats. So anyway, through the auspices of this private stockholding company, the Hudson's Bay Company, the British were sending more and more trapping outfits into this Oregon territory. Naturally, presidents from Jefferson to Madison to Monroe were alarmed. They said, wait a minute, we threw these people out during our revolution a half century ago. And we repelled them during the War of 1812, and now they're trying to sneak into the North American continent through the back door. So Jed Smith, while exploring these territories, while trapping these territories, just kept these copious notes, which became the backbone of our book, Throne of Grace. We were not only was the country lucky that he kept these notes, but Drury and Clavin were pretty lucky also.
Absolutely. All right, so it would seem to me that as he is making these trips, and he made many, many of them, and he went down through Texas and New Mexico, he went through Kansas and Colorado, he was the first person, I believe, the first white man to traverse the Rocky Mountains on both the North Gap and the South Gap. And then he got into what was then Mexican territory, Nevada, California, what eventually became Nevada, California, and Arizona. It would seem to me that it would be a little bit dangerous. Now, there were a lot of different Indian tribes. We've got the Arapaho and the Comanche and the Lakota and the Sioux. I could go on and on and on. But in a lot of cases, they were friendly to people coming through. But in other cases, they were also busy fighting each other. Talk a little bit. Indians fought each other with sometimes the same intensity as they fought the whites.
Oh, certainly. Certainly. I mean, long before any Europeans set foot on North America's fatal shores, the not only the Eastern Woodland Indians, the Shawnee, the Mohawk, but the Western tribes, they had staked out their own territories.
You're listening to a special hour of the Mike Boyle Restaurant Show, where we talk about restaurants, travel, movies, books, sports, and even a little bit of history. And by the way, Bob, I got a kick out of the fact that you put a disclaimer in your book that whatever you want to refer to Native Americans as, we are going to use the term Indians in the book. and you know what? I grew up playing cowboys and Indians, and it was not a pejorative. It was not a slight in any way. So I got a kick out of that. But the Indians fought each other with the same intensity that they often fought the whites, because they were very territorial, even though many of them were very nomadic. Can you address that a little bit?
Well, once again, you set it up perfectly in your intro. Jefferson buys this huge chunk of land, and we don't know what's out there, or more important, who's out there.
He has no idea. I mean, this is like Forrest Gump's box of chocolates. I mean,
exactly. Well, you have the Sioux and the Arikara occupying the Missouri River corridor. Mm-hmm. You got the Pawnee and, as you mentioned, the Comanche and the Kiowa in the southwest. You got the Pawnee and the Cheyenne on the plains. You got the Blackfeet and the Gros Ventre up in the mountains. And they are as territorial as it comes. And once one tribe got guns, then they dominated the other tribes. Mm-hmm. And once one tribe learned to husband, to domesticate horses, then they dominated the plains. So that's why you have the Comanche in the southwest and the Sioux in the upper plains. So here comes Euro-Americans at first, and finally Americans, into this territory, not really knowing what to expect. Early on, Mike, these Indians were helpful. They saved Lewis and Clark. They led that. Lewis and Clark's expedition would have never made the Pacific without the help from the Indian tribes. Yet, as more and more white settlers, more explorers, more beaver trappers start infringing upon their territory, now they're getting a little perturbed, and they start making war on the white men. And Jedediah Smith was right in the middle of all of this.
I got a kick out of the, I learned a lot about the Indians and horses, because we're talking about the beaver, but also as the white man, the Americans, whatever we want to call them, began to hunt buffalo. Buffalo were a real form of sustenance to the Indians. And but when they were hunting buffalo, it's a little bit different than the white man. The white man could shoot a buffalo. He could ride a horse, shoot a buffalo, the buffalo would drop. But the Indians with arrows and spears had to get a lot closer. Talk about how the Indians, you know, I guarantee you that I thought this, and everybody listening to the show thought this. Okay, you're an Indian and you want to go kill a buffalo. You get on any old horse, you ride out there, and you shoot an arrow into the buffalo, and you carve it out for everything from the hooves onto the meat, onto the coat, and everything else. The Indians learned how to groom their horses to hunt buffalo.
From the time colts were foaled, they especially, particularly if a horse was born under what the tribes considered an auspicious sign, a meteor shower, say, or an eclipse, or even a full moon of some sort, they would take that horse and they would swathe it in buffalo robes, and they would, when it was finally old enough to be ridden, they would run it through their own remudas with buffalo. Everything on that horse, whether it was the saddle, was made from buffalo. Whether it was the reins, that was made from buffalo sinew. So these horses, and you might not take a buffalo horse out for 5 years. That's how trained they were. Because buffalo, I mean, we have this idea of the docile animal, this docile animal that will just kind of stare at you. But buffaloes were rough. They would stand and fight. And so these horses and their riders, they had to almost act as one, much like a jockey in the Kentucky Derby. Mm-hmm. You know, they had to think as one. And it was really quite fascinating to learn this whole technique about how buffalo horses were raised and trained.
And the respect, I'm not even sure I want to use the word love, but the respect, the closeness that the Indians felt for their horse. You know, there's an old saying that the outside of a horse is good for the inside of a man. And the Indians really believed that. And I really liked your description of the fate of an aged and dying horse, how the Indians handled it. They could have killed it.
Well, different tribes. I mean, the Apaches would eat every part of the horse.
Yeah.
But there were certain northern tribes, the Sioux in particular, if a horse had lived a good full life and had provided its owner with, whether it was raiding other tribes, whether it was a buffalo horse, towards the end, they would release the horse in a small valley near water, and they would say, we present you to the great father. Mm-hmm. And the horse would, of course, we're talking about valleys crawling with grizzly bear and panthers and rattlesnakes. So, but the horse, they would basically say, we're not going to kill you and eat you. You're on your own. You are free to die however you want to die.
Well, and that's more the circle of life. And you know, I spent a lot of time in Africa. And, you know, I remember the first buffalo I shot, Cape Buffalo. Somebody said, do you feel bad shooting a buffalo? And the PH, the professional hunter, said, that buffalo probably wasn't ready to die, but he'd probably rather get a bullet in his head than be disemboweled by a lion pride. So, you know, there, whether or not it's rattlesnakes and grizzly bears where they release the horse, that is just kind of a little bit the circle of life. Bob, I'm sorry?
I agree.
And I'd like you to talk about the place of dogs in Indian lore. I've got Bailey, the Mexican street dog, born in Sayulita, Mexico, lying on my feet right now as we talk. Talk about dogs in Indian lore.
Well, I don't know if you're ready to eat Bailey, but there was a Jesuit priest, Father de Smet, and he circulated. He was one of the first explorers, you would call him, and journal keepers to circulate among the tribes. And he was just amazed at how many dogs were present in each village, and they were used before horses, before the Spanish released the horses. Dogs were used to pull travois. Dogs were guard dogs, but they were also stew.
Yeah.
And Indians considered dog stew a delicacy.
Yeah.
And that's one of the, it's a funny little anecdote. When Jed Smith first led a company out into, towards the Rockies, out into the Great Plains, and they were greeted in first the Sioux villages, and then the Arikara villages, and then the Mandan villages, and the height of hospitality was to have a feast of dog stew. And Jed Smith, being somewhat of an Easterner, he was born in New York, Susquehanna Valley, but his family moved west as the nation expanded, first to Pennsylvania, what is now Pennsylvania, then to Ohio, and then to Illinois. And he just thought of dogs as probably the way you think of them, as on his feet right now. And when he was offered as a guest of honor, steaming broth of dog stew, he was rather repelled. He ate it, of course, out of just like he would drink wine with the Mexican friars. Mm-hmm. But he did not like it at all.
All right, let's talk a little bit about two things I wanted that really impressed me was your description of hygiene among, let's call them the mountain men. And I'd also like to talk about smallpox. I've got about 2 minutes left in this segment. Let's start with hygiene.
Well,
we think of a shower.
Better term might be lack of hygiene.
but yes, okay. Yes, we think of a shower every day, and there were people that were absolutely Western explorers that were absolutely repulsed by it. And you have a description of them being just covered, their clothing, their skin, their beard, their hair, just black with beaver, buffalo blood. Talk about that for just a second, if you would.
Well, I'll give you a perfect example, and a nice anecdote that we came across. These mountain men, when they first ran across the Crow, they thought the Crow were the most stately Indians they had ever seen. Mm-hmm. And for some reason, natural selection, I'm not sure why, nobody's been ever been able to figure out, but the Crow, unlike most Indians, they had gleaming white teeth, and they kept them in their mouth through old age. But they also bathed every day. They would chop holes in river ice, take a bath. And this just totally, the mountain men were just, why are they jumping in this freezing water? And you mentioned there was one quote where, because a beaver trapping was not a clean game, so to speak. And so you'd get your buckskins in St. Louis, and they would be what we think of as buckskins, as kind of tan brown. After several months in the mountains, they would be just covered with beaver viscera, beaver blood, perhaps your own blood, your own excrement. I mean, these, once again, back east in quote-unquote civilization, there were things like toilet paper. And if you didn't have toilet paper, you'd use a corn cob, or you would use a mussel shell. Up in the mountains, no. No, there was none of that. And so a lot of these men, hairy white beings, is what the Indians called them when they first saw these mountain men. Black, covered in beaver, dried blood, dry viscera. It was a rather amazing clash of civilizations, if you might want to call it that way.
He has a book out along with his partner, Tom Clavin, Throne of Grace. And by the way, I had to read about 280 of the 350-page book to find out where Throne of Grace came from. And when I found out that it came from Hebrew in the Bible, verse 4, I thought, well, I'm just going to ask the minister at my church. And I said, Throne of Grace. And he said, Hebrews 5. And I said, Hebrews 4. And he said, I knew it was there somewhere. So apparently he is a little bit more of a biblical scholar than I. No surprise there. All right, so Bob Drury, author, let's talk about smallpox. Because, you know, somewhere along the line, Columbus discovering the New World and the wiping out of the indigenous people in America, the Indians, the Native Americans, whatever we want to call them, came from Columbus spreading smallpox and so forth. Let's fast forward to the 19th century and these people making their way out west, whether it's in a covered wagon or whether it's to hunt buffalo and beaver. But smallpox was running rampant in this country. No vaccine had been come up with yet. So the Indians, they would do some trading, and whatever the Indians had that the settlers, the adventurers needed, maybe they'd get a musket, maybe they'd get a blanket, maybe they'd get something else. Talk a little bit about that, because the smallpox really did ravage in the 19th century a big part of the Native American population.
Well, not only smallpox, but measles and diphtheria.
Yeah.
All the diseases that the Europeans had some sort of immunity to. I mean, mm-hmm. Of course, many of the American, Euro-Americans who came to the New World contracted smallpox, but many of them survived it, whereas the indigenous tribes, they had no immunity. And so once it spread through a tribe like the Blackfeet, that was the end of the Blackfeet. And you mentioned, you know, to some extent, I know of an example from a previous book I wrote, the Daniel Boone book, Blood and Treasure, where the British in Fort Pitt they would deliberately give the Shawnee, they would call the Shawnee to a peace council, and they would deliberately give them blankets that they knew contained smallpox. But for the most part, it was kind of, especially west of the Mississippi, it was kind of accidental.
More inadvertent, yeah.
Trading would go on, and once one person of the tribe got it, or that clan, I should say the clan, because they didn't all the Blackfeet didn't all camp in one place. The Sioux didn't all camp in one place. But once the village or the clan picked it up, there was no hope. And it was kind of a, I don't know. You mentioned the circle of life before when we were talking about the horses. I don't know. It's almost like a darker version of the circle of life. Mm-hmm. I mean, this has been going on. There were hordes, Mongol hordes carried diseases that the Europeans didn't have back in the Middle Ages. So this is the way it went, but it was certainly certainly devastating. I mean, they say the Comanche, that measles did more to weaken the Comanche than any U.S. Cannon or rifle.
I'll be darned. All right, so we've given folks a little bit of the atmosphere, the environment. Let's talk a little bit more specifically about Jedediah Smith. He was the first to circumnavigate the West's largest inland sea, Utah's Great Salt Lake. He crossed the Mojave Desert. You know, I spent a lot of time in the Mojave Desert. Just driving across the Mojave Desert can be a challenge. The first American to enter California from the east. He was the first American to travel up the West Coast from San Diego to the Canadian border. So this is a guy, he would actually spend not just weeks, months, but oftentimes a couple years. And talk about how he eventually, at 31 years old, met his demise.
You know, Mike, I'm happy and impressed that you use the word American, because of it, Tom and I, we don't use the word discover in our book. Mm-hmm. Daniel Boone no more discovered the Cumberland Gap than Jed Smith discovered South Pass, that chink in the Rocky Mountains that became the Oregon Trail. It was capable of bearing wagons. So Smith had spent 5 years, basically all the firsts you mentioned. He came back to St. Louis. He wrote long, long, long letters. Trust me, they were long. I read them all to President Andrew Jackson, Secretary of War, a man named John Eaton, detailing, as I mentioned before, how many cannon and soldados are in each presidio in California. Where the British, the disposition of the British in the Oregon country. And his idols were Lewis and Clark. And he planned on moving back. In fact, he wrote to his brother. He was a wealthy man. Beaver trapping had made him rich. He decided he was going to write what he called his Encyclopedia of the West. But his younger brother showed up in St. Louis, and they wanted to become mountain men. And he says, oh my goodness, you are not ready for this. But as almost a shakedown cruise, he said, okay, I'll give you a little taste of the West. We're going to put together a wagon train, and we're going to take to Santa Fe along the Santa Fe Trail, and we're going to do a little trading with the Mexicans. But at some point along that trail, they had crossed the Arkansas River, which was the border between Mexico and the United States. And instead of following the kind of well-known Santa Fe Trail, he decided he wanted to take a shortcut across this desert area known as the Water Scrape. Naturally, they ran out of water, so he and another scout went out ahead to look for the Cimarron River, which was an underground river. It only surfaced during heavy rainstorms or when it hit impenetrable rock. He saw a rock outcropping. He said, that must be the Cimarron. So he started riding towards it, and his Mustang, its tongue is lolling out of its mouth. It's staggering. It needs water. He needs water. Suddenly, 15 or 20 riders appear from around that rock outcrop. Their Mustangs, their ponies, their Indian ponies, are well-watered, and sitting on those 15 to 20 horses are Comanche and Kiowa. Now, Jed Smith's got three choices. Try to make a run for it on a staggering horse, but he knows he's not going to outrun those well-watered Indians. He could draw his Creamer long rifle and his brace of flintlock pistols and make a stand, hoping that the gunshots will bring help from the wagon train, which is maybe 5 miles behind him. Or he can brazen it out, and he can ride right up to those Indians and try to parley. He has three choices, Mike. What choice would you make? What choice would I make? Well, the choice Jed Smith made, you're just going to have to read the book to find out, aren't you?
And I did read the book, and I'm not going to tell the listeners what happened. So,
thank you, Mike.
Listen, one other thing that I'd like to, just as a side note, since reading your book, I've asked a few people. I've also read a history of the area where I live in. There's a lot of Douglas counties in the country. I live in Douglas County, Colorado. I just read a history of it. And when you think about the Civil War and how a lot of veterans came to Colorado because of the Homestead Act, they would get 160 acres. But when you read
it,
yes, and you read about Jedediah Smith and Kit Carson, and you read about the migration of these Civil War veterans and what they found and how they had to learn which crops would actually grow in the Colorado soil. You just have to applaud them. You just have to have a sense of awe when it comes to them. So what I'd like to know, and I've thrown this out to a number of people, I suppose you could say that the only areas to really that really remain that can be quote-unquote discovered are in space or under the ocean. Because I know that there's some areas very primitive, whether it's in the Amazon, whether it's in the Nile Basin, some of these areas. I understand that, whether it's down in Indonesia, you read about the disappearance 50 years ago, 60 years ago of Michael Rockefeller. There are some pretty rough areas. But my question for you is, I'm going to ask you to answer it in a word, and then we can elaborate. It is my contention that when I look at American society as it is today, a society of which I'm a member, you're a member. Yes, I like my creature comforts. I'm sure Bob Drury does as well. I think that if it was up to Americans of today, with their softness, that if we were back in 1803, the Louisiana Purchase, we'd still be living east of the Mississippi.
I agree. I'll give you an example. As you know, Mike, for 20 years, I was overseas as a war correspondent.
Yeah, and let me tell you, Bob, I'll tell you what. You've got 30 seconds to give me a synopsis of what you're going to say after this break, and then when we come back, you've got about 5 minutes, okay?
Okay.
So, 30 seconds. You were overseas as a war correspondent. Yep.
As you know, I was shot in Afghanistan. I took shrapnel in Sarajevo. I got blown off a helicopter in Iraq. I had part of my spine taken out. Somebody said to me when we were researching and writing this book, listen, you're supposed to be a tough guy. You were overseas. How long would you last? How would you make it as a mountain man? And my honest answer was I'd last about 3 days.
All right, let's wrap up this special hour, the special edition of the Mike Boyle Restaurant Show, where we talk about restaurants, travel, movies, books. We're talking about the book Throne of Grace, A Mountain Man, An Epic Adventure in the Bloody Conquest of the American West. Bob Drury, along with his partner Tom Clavin, are the authors. I've got Bob with me. Bob, you said, you know what? I think that we all have a little bit of Renaissance man in us. You know, I think sometimes when I'm a little tired of society, when I'm a little tired of people, when I'm a little tired of traffic, when I'm a little tired of 24/7 news cycles, it would have been nice to just ride off into the sunset with my horse, my trusty horse, my beautiful Winchester rifle, and hunt buffalo and spend the winter in a snow cave and relax a little bit. You said that you think that with all of your experiences, you would last about 3 days. I get a kick out of people that want to enter a run called the Tough Mudder. yeah, we're going to go out and we're going to run through the mud and climb over this wall, and it's a 3-mile course. What do you think? You want to do it? And I said, I did it. It was called basic training. But when the when the 3 hours were up, I didn't get to go have a beer. I went to my next assignment. And so consequently, I don't think that American society, yes, we've got tough people in our special forces, our Navy SEALs. Yes, we have people that still believe in this country and that it's worth fighting for and worth defending. But you know what? Everybody wants to say thank you for your service to a veteran. But I know that not many people want their kid to go off and serve. So I feel the same way. I just think that if it was up to this American society today, we would still be living east of the Mississippi, Bob Drury.
Well, I want to. We'll end this segment. I would be remiss if I didn't say. I mentioned I spent a lot of time in the gardens of Eden of this world. Mm-hmm. You know, Afghanistan, Iraq, mm-hmm. Darfur, Liberia, Sarajevo, and I will kind of second your motion that when I write World War II books, and we wrote a best-selling book about the Chosen Reservoir, The Last Stand of Fox Company, and people say to me, boy, those soldiers back then, and I have to correct them, because I've run into soldiers
today
over the last 20 years mm-hmm. who have the same kind of sand mm-hmm. and the same kind of gumption and the same kind of heart that those World War II GIs had, that those Korean War GIs had. So you're right, it's a smaller percentage of the population, but I'm proud every time I run into some 19-year-old kid who is about to take off in a helicopter, and I'm right next to him, and we're flying into Fallujah. Mm-hmm. So maybe that's a way to end this? I don't know. Up to you. It's your show.
Well, and I think that, yes, when you read about what the 1st Marine Division went through when they were at the Chosin Reservoir in Korea, when you read about the winters and the conditions, and, you know, we've got a lot of special gear now, whether you're just a weekend skier, a weekend snowmobiler, but you know what? The same uniform that you wore in the deserts, were the same that you wore in the jungles, were the same that you wore in the cold weather. So a lot of that stuff has come a long ways, but this country is a country of 300 plus million, and there's 20 million veterans. There's 20 million people that have served. And I think that it's interesting. I was approached by a lady the other day, not so very long ago, and I had a small little button on, and she said, "You're a veteran?" And I said, "Yes." And she said, "I don't know what to say to a veteran. Some people say you're supposed to say this. Some people say you're supposed to say that. What do you suggest I say?" I said, I would say the same thing that I say when I see a veteran. Thank you for your service. And I think that when you look at it, when you look at the millions of young Americans from the Revolution through the War of 1812, the Spanish-American War, Mexican-American War, the Civil War, when you look at the Americans that have died defending this way of life, I think that maybe there's a little bit of a message there, Bob, that when you look around, maybe you ought to just take a little time to reflect and a little time to say, you know what, I'm blessed to be an American.
You've said it all, Mike. I cannot add to that.
Well, Bob Drury, thank you so much for this special edition of The Restaurant Show. The book was absolutely terrific, and I've now got you on the list, because when I check out a couple of your other books, I've got a feeling that you'll be getting a call, and I'd love to invite you back.
Oh, and I'd love to be back. Thank you, Mike. I appreciate it.
All right. That wraps up this special hour. Yeah. And we're going to put it on the podcast. Yeah, you'll be able to get it on my website at mikeboyle.com. Look at Overtime, where we do extended features that will hold your interest and I think maybe help all of us learn just a little bit. All right, so that wraps up this hour of The Restaurant Show.